This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The question of what wilderness actually means was somewhat fluid and came up a lot over the course of this conflict. And really, the way wilderness functions legally is as a tool for preservation. So when you designate a place a wilderness area, it's not so much that you're saying this is the most remote place there is. It's what you're going to do with that space that matters. So it's more practical than philosophical.
What does the word wilderness evoke in your mind? A vast field, a dense forest, a body of water? If you're an attorney, it may simply be a legal term. It turns out that how the law defines wilderness can be pretty significant for conservation efforts, for private enterprise, and for food production. Our first guest today on Sea Change Radio is Summer Brennan, whose recent book, The Oyster War, tells the story of a legal struggle concerning an oyster farm in Northern California. The case hinges largely on the definition of wilderness, and made a bit of a splash, if you will, with Fox News and the Koch brothers. We delve into the history of the Drake's Bay Oyster Company and talk about the hostilities that ensued when the government tried to shut it down. Later, we revisit my discussion with Doug Woodring of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, whose Hong Kong-based organization continues the fight to clean up our ocean wilderness. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Summer Brennan. Her new book is The Oyster War. Summer, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So why don't you first tell us how you stumbled across this very interesting story about oysters and the battle that unfolded from Point Reyes, not that far from San Francisco.
Sure. Well, I'd actually never heard of the conflict before, although I'm from West Marin and I grew up in the Bay Area. I am a journalist, and I was working on some freelance stories, and I thought it would be interesting to write some environmental pieces about the Bay Area. And I was thinking who might be interested, and I thought it might be possible to do some freelance pieces for the Point Reyes Light, which was my local paper out in West Marin. So I called them up to pitch some stories, and instead the editor offered me a full-time job, and so I started working there. And this was sort of their main story at the time, so that's how I was introduced. I sort of, you know, jumped in with both feet.
Well, introduce us to the story then, if you can give us a brief overview.
Okay. Well, there was an oyster farm inside Point Reyes National Seashore. And spoiler alert, I guess, it closed down at the beginning of this year, January 1st. And this big battle ended up being waged between the two sides. On the one hand, you had the pro-oyster farm group that wanted the farm to be able to stay past the expiration of its 40-year lease in 2012. Many in that group were of the mind that the oyster farm was a sustainable business and provided jobs in the community and other benefits, and so it should be allowed to continue, even though the area where the farm was had been designated as a wilderness area. So on the other hand, people were worried that allowing the farm to continue past its lease in a designated wilderness area would imperil wilderness throughout the country, because it would have been the first time that a wilderness designation was weakened or undone in any way. So on the sort of, you know, pro-wilderness side, you had people sort of advocating for it to be shut down. Maybe they had criticisms about the farm itself, maybe not, and it was just sort of about the precedent that was going to be set. So this fight started as a sort of local tempest in a teapot and ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court.
Just to be clear, you said it was a 40-year lease that expired in 2012, is that correct?
That's right. When Point Reyes National Seashore was formed, part of that land, a large part, came from agricultural land that was in the area. And those ranchers and dairy farmers that lived there sold their land to the federal government, mostly in the 70s, and then leased it back. And so they became tenants, and they have these, you know, renewing leases. And during that period in 1972, the oyster farm that had been there on and off since the 30s, did something similar. They only had a few acres because they didn't own the estuary. They just owned the on-site land. They sold that land and also got a lease. But instead of the renewing short leases, they got a 40-year reservation of use and occupancy. However, 4 years after that, in 1976, they designated the area as a wilderness area, which it's argued that would make it that the lease for 40 years would likely not be renewed after that time.
And yet, in 2005, Kevin Lunny bought the oyster farm. He knew that this lease expired in 2012, did he not?
He did. And I mean, that was the expiration date on the lease. When it was signed in 1972, it was before the wilderness designation. So there was a clause in the lease that said it could be renewed depending on park policies in place at the time.
And then by 2012, the park was saying, we're not going to renew it.
Right. And so he was told, and he's told reporters earlier on in this conflict, especially one reporter for Marin magazine in 2008, that he knew that they didn't plan to renew the lease. That not only did it expire, but that he'd been told both by the park staff and by the former owners of the oyster farm that they didn't intend to renew it, but that he was optimistic that if he could do a great job cleaning it up, that they would be really impressed and hopefully issue a special permit for him to continue after 2012.
But his complaint when it wasn't reissued was a little less hopeful. He was more irate. He said he didn't get ample time and that these oysters need several months to be harvested, and it would cost him a lot of money with the time constraints, which is it was a little odd to me. He was like, yeah. You just gave me you said August 29th that you're not going to renew it, and then by August 30th, you want me to stop farming on this land. And prima facie, that does seem quite quick, but when you consider that he bought this in 2005, 7 years before that date, he kind of knew what was coming. This couldn't have caught him by surprise, could it have?
No, there was pushback from the very beginning. So you're right, that there was plenty of notice about the farming.
So this whole area has oysters. This is the Drake's Bay Oyster Company is not the only game in town, is it?
No. The oyster farms in Tomales Bay are on the other shore, so it's a bit of a longer drive. But Tomales Bay itself was only a quick 10-minute drive from Drake's Estero. So it's very close. And Tomales Bay is neither a national park or a wilderness area, unlike Drake's Estero, which is both. So it's fine to have commercial businesses operating there. So there are two kind of big oyster companies, oyster farms in Tomales Bay, Tomales Bay Oyster Company and Hog Island Oyster Company. And both are, you know, doing very well. And Hog Island in particular has won some awards, and Tomales Bay is really great too and very popular. And then there are other oyster companies and smaller oyster leases in Tomales Bay as well. So they're in the region. But in terms of the impact of oyster farming, there's many different ways to farm oysters. During the course of the writing of this book, I was fortunate enough to make the acquaintance of oyster farms and oyster farmers on the East Coast too. I'm from the Bay Area, but I live in Brooklyn now most of the time. And so I got to go out and visit oyster farms, an oyster farm in Long Island where the famous Blue Point oysters come from, and speak to oyster farmers around. So in that area, there where oysters are native and still grow wild, some of those oysters, they're foraging. And so there's regulations about it. So they'll go out to an oyster reef in Long Island Sound, you know, kind of guarded location, because they don't want everybody to go out and pick it clean. And so they'll go down with scuba gear and cut the oysters from the beds with knives. And, you know, there's a lot of regulations on how many you can take, I think, and what size. So you want to make sure that you're not taking the oysters before they had a chance to reproduce and that kind of thing. So similar to like the lobster industry in Maine, there's rules about that to keep the stock going.
But not as stringent as like abalone, for example.
No, not at all. And so there aren't many wild oyster reefs in the New York area anymore. I mean, it used to be absolutely packed with them, and there's fewer, but they are there, and they're working to restore them. And again, it's a native species growing where it grew for thousands of years probably, and they do harvest them, and you know, you can eat those in restaurants. I had some actually at my book signing in Brooklyn a couple weeks ago. So anyway, so that's one way to farm oysters. It's not really farming, it's a foraging operation. But those same companies also farm them. And so it's the same species of oyster that they have wild, but they're growing them in bags or attached to strings or wires or rods that they have in certain parts of estuaries or bays, and then they can move them around. And there's a lot of benefits to farming them that way, because maybe a part of the bay is really good for young oysters, but if you put them in a different part, it makes them very sweet. And so you can move them around. I compare oysters to wine grapes a lot, in the sense that their environment is very important for the end product. And so you can have the same oyster species, but the variety changes depending on where it's grown, which ocean, and in, as I said, even individual parts of the bay.
So the Drake's Bay Oyster Company farms their oysters. They don't forage them, correct?
Right. Well, there are not native oyster populations in the Bay Area. And one of the things I came across in my research is that there has never been an oyster industry in California that was based off of native oysters.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that was a big surprise to me, because I always assumed that the 19th century oyster barons that lived in San Francisco, which were a thing, that they started out with native oysters, but their oysters were all coming from elsewhere. They were shipping them down from Washington or out via train from New York.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Summer Brennan. Her latest book is The Oyster War, the true story of a small farm, big politics, and the future of wilderness in America. So Summer, one of the quotes that one of the reviewers of your book, Ann Zimmerman, gives is, "The Oyster War is a must-read for anyone who cares about the poetry and politics of the plate." You mentioned that this is being fought in the courts, but why don't you mention some of the local politics involved and give us a sense of the pulse of the region? Like, has Kevin Lunny won over the locals, or is he kind of fighting an uphill battle within his community?
Well, actually, the oyster farm and its owners and employees had a lot of local public support, even not just local. I mean, Senator Dianne Feinstein was a big advocate for them, and she managed to, you know, put in some legislation to try to help the farm continue. It didn't actually end up working out that way. But so, no, they have quite a lot of support, and I think that they're, you know, valued members of the community, and so many people, lots of people came to their defense and supported them.
Including the Koch brothers and Fox News.
Well, yes, that too. So the thing about this story is, because it was, you know, a business sort of fighting the government, it got appropriated, I think, by a lot of groups. And so it became kind of a conservative cause across the country. And a lot of people that support Cliven Bundy and what he's doing with his ranching, they sort of put the Lunnies in with that same category.
Is that fair?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's fair or not. I mean, it's similar. There's similarities to it, in the sense that it's, you know, having agriculture on government land and not wanting to follow the rules that the government sets for that land.
I couldn't help but laugh when I heard the political forces that are backing Kevin Lunny. So the locals, as you mentioned, who are probably very progressive here in Northern California, and also the Cliven Bundy backers on Fox and Friends. That's a kind of a strange alliance.
Yeah, well, that phrase came up a lot, strange bedfellows. And I think that, you know, many people, I mean, honestly, my experience is talking to some people that aren't actually living out in West Marin, but supported the oyster farm. Many of them didn't quite understand the story totally. And in speaking, you know, in reading my book, they would be like, oh, well, I thought the oysters were just growing native out there and they were harvesting them. And I said, no, you know, they're Japanese oysters imported and they're all grown in bags. And there's a lot of plastic that they use in the operation. And one of the issues with the farm is that they weren't able to keep that plastic under wraps. It would escape and get out and end up on the beaches around the seashore. And so I think that when people looked at it more closely, they were like, oh, okay, it's not quite what I thought it was. Or they thought that, you know, the Lennies owned the land and they were just being forced off as in a case of eminent domain. And they just didn't really quite understand the details of it or didn't understand the wilderness designation. And I think that some groups that were interested in this cause, you know, didn't quite mention that. There was one review of my book that was quite long, 2,000 words or so, but it never mentioned wilderness once in the whole review. And then they said, you know, we still don't know why they made the farm leave. And it's sort of interesting because I do devote quite a bit of time in the book to talking about what wilderness means and the wilderness designation. And
so, Summer, you said that these oysters are not native, but would it be possible to create a more of a foraging type atmosphere? If Kevin Lunny had taken over the Drake's Bay Oyster Company in 2005, and knowing that the lease was possibly going to expire in 2012, if he didn't get all of his environmental ducks in a row, could he have transformed it into much more of a wild foraging oyster company slash farm, even if it wasn't as productive in terms of the space used and the efficiency of the seabed?
Right. Well, I mean, one important point is the decision to have him leave in 2012 didn't have anything to do with his environmental practices or whether he could clean up the farm. And I think that's a misconception as well, that he wasn't really on trial. It wasn't like, well, if you can prove that you are environmentally sound for the estuary, then you can stay. That was never the case.
So no matter what he had done, you think his lease was going to be revoked?
Yes, that was very clear. And I think he didn't quite agree with that, but that was very clearly the case. It was not going to be renewed. It was explained beforehand. And I think, like I said, he just thought, well, I can't say what Kevin himself thought, but, you know, based on what he said to media over time, the impression was that they would just get them to change their mind if they could show that they were great environmental stewards. But it wasn't about that. And also, looking into the history of the previous oyster farm, the infrastructure of that place was just not set up to be the most environmentally sound business, no matter what they were doing. They really would have had to overhaul everything and change their techniques because there was just decades of problems backed up. Because it wasn't just an oyster farm, but they had a small village that they had there for their workers of mobile homes. And so one of the biggest problems in previous decades was actually sewage leaking into the bay because it had been built for one family in one home. And then there was, you know, 30 different people or so living on site. So it was just too much. Anyway, but about the operation in the bay, there's no evidence that oysters were ever prevalent in Drake's Estero. It's not oyster habitat. Oysters they need hard substrate, which is in sort of short supply in the Bay Area in general. But Drake's Estero in particular has a soft mud bottom, which is full of eelgrass. And it's just not really oyster habitat. And so some shells have been found in the area near the Estero that are oyster shells that are very old, from like 1,200 years ago. And archaeologists that looked at those shells and analyzed them, they did carbon dating and, you know, to see how old they were. And they also wondered if, you know, maybe they came from the Estero, but also they were in a trade site. So they also could have just come from somewhere else, either in the Bay Area or from somewhere else entirely. So to try to have a native population of oysters in Drake's Estero would be very challenging. You'd have to change the character of the estuary. You'd have to change the bottom. You'd have to put a lot in to get oysters to live there. And there isn't a lot of evidence that they were ever a baseline species of that particular estuary. So that's another issue that comes up for the issue of making it a foraging operation.
So anybody who's been to Point Reyes has enjoyed the natural beauty, Summer, of this area. Yet it's not the most wild place in Northern California. There's plenty of residences nearby. Is it really a wilderness? And was this part of the argument that Kevin Lunny was making?
So the question of what wilderness actually means was somewhat fluid and came up a lot over the course of this conflict. Legal wilderness means one thing in terms of whether or not you can have paved roads or power lines or structures or commercial businesses, you're not supposed to have them. Sometimes they'll bend the rules a little bit to facilitate park visitors. But people don't agree on what wilderness means. And really, the way wilderness functions legally is as a tool for preservation. So when you designate a place a wilderness area, it's not so much that you're saying this is the most remote place there is. It's what you're going to do with that space that matters. So it's more practical than philosophical. So it's okay that it's close to areas that are not wilderness. It's more just that it was recognized that this ecosystem was a vital ecosystem that supported many, many different organisms, and it needed to be preserved. And it helps support surrounding ecosystems that aren't necessarily wilderness either, because I think people can forget that a little bit.
Well, it's a fascinating tale, and I recommend our listeners go pick it up. It's The Oyster War, and the author is Summer Brennan. Summer, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the founder of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, Doug Woodring. Doug, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Good. Great to have you back on the show. We spoke almost 5 years ago, and folks can go listen to our conversation about Project Kaisei, which is not that dissimilar from what Ocean Recovery Alliance is focusing on, which is trying to remove waste and plastic from our oceans. For our listeners who are not familiar with the Pacific Gyre, why don't you explain what that is and how it's grown over the years?
Well, briefly, all ocean currents, all big oceans have, well, all oceans and water bodies have current flows. And it just it is that the big oceans, Pacific, Atlantic, Indian, have circulatory currents, which essentially work like a giant whirlpool in your bathtub or your sink. And so when those go around the continents, they tend to grab anything that's on the outer fringes that gets pushed into them, and maybe which doesn't get blown back into land. And in the past, no one's paid much attention, partly because not many people go out to these remote areas that are thousands of miles from shore. They're not on the shipping routes. Very few sailors go there because in the summers they're often void of wind, so there's no reason for people to go out there and monitor. But what people started finding, those who did go there, was that there's more and more and more garbage in that part of the world, and they wondered where it's coming from. And the fact is that when you have plastic that doesn't readily biodegrade and floats, then those things which get swirling around in this part of the water just keep swirling. And, you know, unfortunately, they break down and animals start eating them, whether it's birds or fish, and then some of them sink. And so this is what we were studying. And why is it growing? Some studies have shown or assume that the Atlantic side is not growing as much. And maybe that is because the last 20 or 30 years, both sides of the Atlantic Ocean governments have done a lot on litter control and litter management. But other parts of the world are still not quite doing those kind of litter projects, and they don't have the resources for recycling and waste management, and they're consuming more and more as populations grow, and that gets into riverways and gets out into the water system and the ocean. And that's the macro issue we're trying to slow down, basically.
And why don't you explain what the mission of the Ocean Recovery Alliance is?
The mission of Ocean Recovery Alliance is to really create new and innovative projects that bring together surprising ideas and collaborations. We work a lot with businesses and governments in order to bring them to the table, because we really need them to help scale the solutions. When you and I can do things like use less plastic when we shop and in the products we buy, we can recycle more. But to really get to scale impact, we really need large volume of these changes. And that's where companies and governments can get involved. So we're working, we have two projects of the Clinton Global Initiative that we announced. They're the two only projects that I know of that are global in scope around plastic pollution that any country can use, also without the need for bans or taxes or legislation, which inevitably always slow things down. And so by having these programs, it gets the business community or the consumer and general community engaged in a bigger way on waste management issues, particularly plastic, because paper and matte glass and metal organics can all relatively be treated as a recycled component. But plastic has so many variables with the different types of material, very hard to get economies of scale and to recycle it with all the different types and colors and weights. And it's the toughest challenge.
And what are microplastics?
So microplastics are the end result of big pieces of plastic. So plastic photodegrades, but it doesn't biodegrade, and except maybe hundreds or thousands of years later. So when you have something in the sun and a wave action, you know, up against rocks or something, it gets brittle over time and it breaks down, just like your lawn chair furniture in the sun over a few years. And that becomes microplastic. So also you have small beads that are in many, many cosmetic products now for facial scrubs, even toothpaste will have tiny, tiny little synthetic beads, which are plastic and not natural. They used to be maybe the grinds of apricot seeds or something like that. And then companies figured out it's just much easier and also safer for allergy reasons to use plastic. And problem is there's no water system, government, municipal water system in the world that can actually capture these little microplastics. Once you wash your face or use things out of the sink, they go into the water system. So those are pre-created plastic microplastics, but all the big pieces that you and I might see on the beach and or on the street or in a river that gets washed out will become a microplastic over time once it gets worn down.
And are these consumer products generally? What are some of the low-hanging fruit specifically in terms of the repurposing, reusing of these kind of plastic materials? Is this from an industrial side of things, or are these just things that we'd find in a convenience store?
It's both and everything. I mean, all types of plastic literally have a way to be recycled. But the problem is that not many of our communities have the recycling capacity to handle every and all of those types, because there's so many. So when you get a bunch of candy wrappers and food products that are lightweight and hard to capture and hard to get into the system again, then they don't get dealt with. And they go to the bushes or the parks, or they're thrown on the ground and they're, you know, flushed out to sea when there's a big rain or wind. When you have industrial material, computer parts or car parts or chairs or something, that's bigger, heavier, it's easier for people to get and reuse, but it's not always happening. Again, it really depends what country you're in, because a lot of countries just do not have good systems.
The founder of Ocean Recovery Alliance, Doug Woodring. Doug, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Taj Mahal, Pete Townsend, and Rai Cooter. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com.
That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.